From Ground Zero Radio, this is Democracy Now!
When I leave here and go, when I leave this world, I don't have a clue as to where I'm going or what's going to be. But I realize that I'm in hell now, so I can't go there. I got to go to heaven.
Thomas Miller L. is scheduled to die on February 21st. Today, we'll take a look at his case on Texas death row, why so many African Americans were excluded from serving on his jury. We'll talk with Javier Carquera, director of Back of the World. It tells the story of Thomas Miller L. and Kurdish political prisoner Leyla Zana. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. In a move that's being celebrated by transnational corporations, Pakistani President General Pervez Musharraf and the Afghan interim leader Hamid Karzai agreed yesterday to begin work on a proposed gas pipeline from Central Asia to Pakistan via Afghanistan. Pakistan and several multinational oil companies, including the California-based Unocal Corporation and Bridas of Argentina, have long attempted to construct a nearly 1,000-mile pipeline from Turkmenistan through Afghanistan to growing natural gas markets in Pakistan and potentially India. But the project has failed to materialize because of the war in Afghanistan and the reluctance of the financial institutions to finance it. The pipeline and other exploitation of gas and oil in Afghanistan have been top priorities of President George Bush and several past U.S. administrations. Many critics of Bush's war also view oil as one of the primary motivations for Washington's attacks on Afghanistan. Afghan villagers who were allegedly misidentified by U.S. military forces as al-Qaeda and Taliban fighters say they were beaten and kicked by their captors and imprisoned what they described as a wooden-barreled cage at a U.S. base in Kandahar. Several of the 27 former prisoners who were released Wednesday said U.S. soldiers treated them so harshly that two men lost consciousness during the beatings while others suffered fractured ribs, loosened teeth, and swollen noses. At the end of their 16-day ordeal, the men were told they would be released and given new clothes, wool hats, and boots. The villagers had repeatedly told their captors that they supported the leader of the interim government, Hamid Karzai. The Pentagon has acknowledged that last month's raids were conducted in error, and the prisoners were neither members of al-Qaeda nor Taliban fighters. Local officials have put the death toll at 21, while survivors of the raid have said two of Karzai's commanders were among the men killed. Israeli warplanes and U.S.-made Apache helicopters attacked the Palestinian security headquarters in Gaza City today. Six missiles hit the large walled compound in the heart of the city, setting buildings ablaze and sending black smoke into the sky. The attack came at a time of changeover between morning and afternoon shifts at nearby schools, and streets were crowded with children who ran away from the explosions, some screaming in panic. Electricity in Gaza City was cut after the airstrike. 37 people were injured, four critically, in the second airstrike on Gaza City in 2 days. Noelle Bush, the niece of President George W. Bush, has been admitted to a drug rehabilitation program. The daughter of the Florida governor, Jeb Bush, was arrested last month for trying to buy the drug Xanax with a fraudulent prescription. A spokesperson for former Enron chief Ken Lay has announced the former Enron CEO will invoke the Fifth Amendment right against self-incrimination and refuse to answer questions when he appears before Congress tomorrow. Lay had been scheduled to appear before two committees last week, but abruptly backed out after his lawyer said he feared those hearings would become too prosecutorial. He'll appear tomorrow under subpoena. In further Enron developments, the Labor Department announced yesterday it is seeking to oust the trustees of Enron's 401k plan because they had not adequately protected the participants. Unless the trustees agree to step down, the department says it'll seek a court order to remove them. And finally, a new study to be released today says that death sentences are more likely to be reversed in areas that often use the death penalty, have higher African-American populations, and where judges face political pressure. We're joined on the phone now by Columbia Law Professor James Liebman, who is the study's lead researcher. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Good morning.
In just a minute, can you describe your chief finding in this study?
Well, our most important finding is that the more often states and counties use the death penalty, the more likely it is that any death verdict they impose will be reversed because of serious error. Aggressive death sentencing is a magnet for serious error.
Can you talk about where the reversal has taken place?
Well, reversals have taken place all over the country, but a number of states that have the highest rates are, for example, Florida, Arizona, Georgia. Those are states where you have relatively high death sentencing rates and quite high reversal rates, capital error rates.
Can you talk about what is meant by a flawed capital sentence, that the whole issue of areas that rely heavily on the death penalty as punishment most likely to impose a flawed capital sentence?
Yes, what we did was to look at what reasons the courts gave for most of the reversals. We did this at the two latter stages of appeals in the state courts and in the federal courts. We found that between 75% and 80% of all of those reversals were for three reasons. The first was egregiously incompetent representation by defense lawyers. The second was prosecutors suppressing evidence, showing that the defendant may be innocent or at least that the case was more mitigated than the jury was told. And third, instructions to juries that were faulty or mistaken.
What do you think? What most surprised you about this study?
Well, one of the most surprising things about this is that you expect that as people do things over and over again, they get better at it. What we found out, however, is that the more you use the death penalty, the more likely error is. It seems to be something that you actually get worse at the more you use it. We were also surprised to see the extent to which there were racial factors operating, not just in deciding who gets the death penalty, something that's long been known, but also in whose cases are found to be erroneous thereafter.
Well, I want to thank you very much for joining us, Jim Liebman, the chief researcher in the study being released today on the death penalty.
It all began when they took me from my home and put me on death row, a crime for which I'm totally innocent, you know. I began to warm and chill to objects and their feels, a ragged cup, a twisted mop, the face of Jesus in my soup, those sinister dinner deals, the meal trolley's wicked wheels, a hook bone rising from my food, and all things either good or ungood. And the mercy seat is waiting, and I think my head is burning, and in a way I'm yearning to be done with all this weighing of the truth. An eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, and anyway I told the truth, and I'm not afraid to die.
I hear stories. Mercy Seat, Johnny Cash, here on Democracy Now! Breaking the Sound Barrier. I'm Amy Goodman as we turn to the case of death row prisoner Thomas Miller L. He's scheduled to be executed in Texas on February 21st. His case has been appealed to the Supreme Court, which is expected to make its decision on Friday on whether or not to hear his case. If the Supreme Court decides to hear his case, he will be granted an automatic temporary stay of his execution. Miller L. was convicted of the 1985 murder of a white man, Douglas Walker, during a robbery at a Holiday Inn near Dallas. But many believe that Thomas Miller L., who is African-American, never received a fair hearing. There's overwhelming evidence that at the time of his trial, Dallas County prosecutors were engaged in racist jury selection tactics in an effort to exclude African-American jurors. We now turn to a documentary on the case of Thomas Miller L. It's called A Pattern of Exclusion, The Trial of Thomas Miller L. It was produced and directed by Emily and Sarah Kunstler. It begins with Jim Marcus, who is Thomas Miller L.'s attorney. The perception that African Americans are not accorded equality before the law is pervasive. A According to a 1985 study conducted by the Dallas Morning News of 100 randomly selected felony trials in Dallas County, a qualified black juror has a 1 in 10 chance of serving on a jury, while a qualified white juror has a 9 in 10 chance, Jim Marcus.
Trial, each side is allowed to challenge the qualifications of any juror if they cannot follow the law, and that's called a challenge for cause. And you can do that as many times as you come across a juror who is not capable of following the law. But in addition to removing jurors who cannot, or potential jurors who cannot follow the law, each side is given a limited number of what are called peremptory challenges or peremptory strikes. And those you can exercise on any basis at all. The only limitation on a peremptory strike is they cannot be exercised on the basis of race. It's so clear in this case what happened. And if we fail to correct it, if the courts fail to correct it, it sends a message that, you can get away with it, and that, you know, a little bit of racial discrimination is okay.
My name is Dorothy Miller-Rill. I'm the wife of Thomas Joe Miller-Rill. Thomas has an execution date for February 21st, 2002. I never knew that the laws of the land could be so corrupt and so unfair until I, myself, was caught up in the system.
In 1986, Thomas Joe Miller-Rill was convicted of murder in Dallas County Court and sentenced to death. 10 of the 11 potential qualified black jurors were peremptorily stricken by the prosecution in Mr. Miller-Rill's trial. This is Carol Bogus.
And I'm a housewife, first of all, and a mother of 3 sons.
All right, my name is Wayman Kennedy, and so I live in Dallas, Texas.
My name is Billy Fields. I'm a resident of Dallas, Texas for the last 35, 40 years.
And I've been residing in Dallas, Texas all of my life.
I've been employed with IBM for 24 years.
In the fall of 67, I became a postal employee.
And I'm an occupational therapist.
I spent 3 years in the Army.
I have been a Sunday school teacher. I'm a deacon.
I work with children in the community, doing Boy Scouts as a den mother.
We do outreach work there. We have seminars that we teach people about the Bible and God and their personal responsibility to Him.
I think it was 1986. I was summoned for jury duty.
I was called basically almost once a year.
I was told at that time that I had been chosen to serve on a panel for a criminal case.
The only cases I've ever sat on were civil cases.
I was eager and willing to serve and be an impartial juror.
There's no reason why I couldn't be fair.
I feel I could have been a fair juror because I feel that I could render a fair opinion by listening to the evidence.
I'm concerned about crime in my community, and just particularly my neighborhood community right now.
If one is guilty of an offense, then he has to pay the penalty set forth by the statutes enforced within a state.
If someone commits a crime, then they should pay the consequences.
Yes, I would be able to render the death penalty.
Yeah, I could vote for the death penalty, yes.
If I had felt that beyond a shadow of a doubt he was guilty and indeed deserved the death penalty, then I could have given him that sentence.
Yes, I was surprised to find that the prosecution was the one that struck me because I would have thought it would have been the other way around, yes.
It was a surprise because I was expected to be possibly rejected by the defense because of some of the questions that had been asked. And as a matter of fact, after everything was over, the judge called me up and commented that he was surprised that the prosecution had stricken me himself.
Do not take Jews, Negroes, Dagos, Mexicans, or a member of any minority race on a jury, no matter how rich or well-educated. This is an internal memo from the Dallas County District Attorney's Office in 1963. The Dallas County District Attorney Training Manual around 1980 said, what to look for in a juror. You are not looking for any member of a minority group. Back to Wayman Kennedy, one of the excluded jurors.
A juror. You are... not looking for any member of a minority group.
Which may subject them to oppression.
They almost always empathize with the accused.
I don't like women jurors because I can't trust them.
That's bogus.
Well, I think that this...
They're reading from the Dallas County District Attorney's manual and comment.
As a black and African-American, you can't render a right decision.
White Protestant Americans are the ones that have the right to serve in this country and even live in this country.
It really upsets me that they think like that, that they think that they can't trust me, not even knowing who I am.
It's not right for the justice system to be biased like this, but it's no surprise.
At the time that I joined the district attorney's office,
this is Larry Baraka,
the DA,
former Dallas DA.
Two other black people in its history. I really don't need to look at that. I've always had opinions about this. I remember this thing. The policy, in a nutshell, was try to get an all-white jury of old white men. In terms of if all the other prosecutors followed the suggestions or dictates of this manual, there's absolutely no question. I was the only exception to that rule.
My name is Ballin Bradley. I was an assistant district attorney in Dallas, Texas, from 1978 through 1981.
From 1972 through 1976, I was a prosecutor in the Dallas County District Attorney's Office.
I started work in the DA's office in January of 1981, and I retired from my public service there in January of 1989.
A December 1986 Dallas Morning News study said from 1980 to 86, the Dallas County DA's office excluded many African Americans.
All people, black Americans, everybody should have the right to serve on a jury. I was not familiar with the numbers. I'm surprised the numbers are that. It's almost impossible to believe that they could be that, but if it is, it is. I certainly think that it's an important function of our government, serving on a jury.
Former Dallas DA Ballin Bradley.
Yes, I do believe that.
Here's Julius Whittier, another former Dallas DA.
Excluded for various reasons from capital murder jury selection.
When I was in the district attorney's office, I felt like there was an unofficial policy to exclude black jurors from jury service.
It was a policy, and that policy is so strong that even to this day, it has not thoroughly left the mentality of the DA's office.
I probably was the only law student either invited or allowed to attend what was the first Dallas County District Attorney's Office-sponsored prosecutor school, is what we called it. And I attended the seminar in 1971, and I heard John Sparling give what I can now probably accurately call his infamous talk or speech pertaining to jury selection for prosecutors.
The speech by Assistant District Attorney Joe Sparling was later incorporated into the Dallas County District
Attorney
Manual.
I remember John giving this talk. I also had a copy of the manual. And I can remember him talking about, just simply put, striking blacks off the juries. There was no, you know, outrage, and certainly nobody got up and walked out after John made these comments. And I suspect that was because it was just so much common knowledge. It's just the way business was conducted at the time. Strike the blacks off the jury and roll on.
Dallas Morning News, December 86. For all 15 men tried for capital murder in Dallas County since 1980, prosecutors got what they wanted, the death penalty and overwhelmingly white jurors. Back to the former DA.
Much anti-black or anything of the nature that, oh, they're not smart or not good people, or it wasn't anything like that. It was more that they would empathize with the defendant. And the goal is to win. The Code of Criminal Procedure says not to convict, but see that justice is done. Truthfully, in a way, promotions depend upon convictions. You lose all your jury trials, you're not going up. You're not going to be promoted, and you want to win.
Sitting here...
Thomas Miller L.
Waiting to die, waiting for the state to execute me, I think has been a very challenging experience, but it's not as challenging as it gets, because the closer you get to the execution date, then the more stress, the more pressure that you're under, right? And the more hopeless you feel, the more helpless you feel, the more, I guess you say that you start to think about the fact that you won't even exist no more in this world. It's for me so far, it's been not as difficult as I imagine it will probably become as the days turn into nights. Basically because I'm at peace with myself, and I've tried to live the type of life, even here on death row, that would actually complement my spirit.
Troy Woods, the only African-American juror to serve on Mr. Miller L.'s trial, said, "Execution's too quick. They don't feel the pain. What I call punishment is back to the old Indian days. Pour some honey on them."
To assume that one group of people, you know, are more capable.
This is Zan Holmes,
judging,
pastor.
A person as to whether or not they are guilty or not. I mean, it's racist at the very core. And to assume that black people will excuse people and will not be faithful in the exercise of their responsibilities is an insult.
It has a very negative impact on the criminal justice system. One, it isolates a significant portion of the community, be they women, men, black, white, or whatever, who have life experiences that can help them as well make choices and decisions about what goes on down there.
So it is a very important right that African Americans be selected to serve on juries and participate in the justice system, because
excluded juror Billy Fields,
by crime as much as anyone else.
Black people have just as much stake in
former
the success
DA,
of their
Julius Whittier
as white folks have in theirs.
The fact that someone would discriminate against me certainly makes me angry.
Former juror Carol Bogus.
For whatever reason, you know, and not look at me as a person, as an individual, but as a color or because of my sex.
If you're not participating in the system, I mean, that in itself is one that makes you less trustful.
Reverend Zan Holmes.
Of a system. And you also question whether or not you can really get a fair trial.
It certainly, you know, brings things home, and it makes you not trust, not be as trusting.
I mean, it troubles me that there have people who have been sentenced, convicted by juries that were selected on the basis of these this criteria.
There was a time that white folks in courts said black people had no rights, they had to be respected.
Former DA Larry Brock.
They at least recognize there are rights to be respected, just maybe not on the same level.
But I try not to really focus off of death itself, because I don't really know what death is. I'm just now beginning to learn what life
Miller
is, and I'm not actually sure that I still know. So the hardest thing of all is the effect that it have on your family, because I have a wife and a have children and brothers and sisters, and knowing that that they're gonna be going through not a lot, it's difficult. And my only hope for me is to be strong for them, because I don't want them to hate nobody when I die. I don't want them to hate the government. I don't want them to hate the state. I don't want them to hate the executioner. It's enough hate in the world. And so for me to just be able to be strong and to continue to keep my spirits up and to deal with each day, one day at a time, and hope that someday that the world in which we live moves beyond just the worship of materialistic things and politics and money. And hope one day that these things will be way behind love, because love is the only thing, spiritual love is the only thing that really matters, the sanctity of the human spirit.
That was Thomas Miller L. He is scheduled to die on February 21st. His case has gone to the Supreme Court. This documentary, called A Pattern of Exclusion, The Trial of Thomas Millerell, produced and directed by Emily and Sarah Kunstler. You're listening to Democracy Now! Back in a minute. Music from La Spalla del Mundo, The Back of the World. And you are listening to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Thomas Millerell was recently portrayed in this feature documentary called The Back of the World, directed by Peruvian filmmaker Javier Corcuera. It is really more than a movie. It is a movement that has spread throughout Spain and Europe. The Back of the World portrays the lives of people who live in the world's shadow, a group of children who chop rocks in Peru to make a living for their families. A Kurdish prisoner of conscience who languishes in a Turkish prison for speaking Kurdish in the Turkish parliament, Leyla Zana. And the family members of people who are on death row in Texas. It features Thomas Millerell. As a result of his nearing execution date, thousands of people who've seen the film have mobilized to try to stop the execution. The film has screened in union halls, high schools, community centers, and theaters all over Spain and Europe, where people have signed petitions and raised money for Millerell's legal case. On Friday, 200 people demonstrated in front of the U.S. Embassy in Madrid against the execution and handed over a petition signed by more than 5,000 people asking for the execution to be halted. We're joined in our Firehouse studio by the filmmaker, by Javier Corcuera, as well as the former Democracy Now! Producer, Maria Carrion, who will speak as well as translate for Javier. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you.
It's good to have you with us. Can you describe first the protests that happened on Friday?
Que describas la manifestación del viernes.
Sí, bueno, fue una concentración delante de la embajada norteamericana.
It was a demonstration in front of the American embassy.
Unas 200 personas.
About 200 people.
En las que entre se encontraban personalidades, periodistas.
There were a lot of journalists, a lot of well-known people there.
Sindicatos.
Unions.
Organizaciones de derechos humanos.
Human rights organizations.
Y Joaquín Martínez, que es un preso español que salió hace unos meses del corredor de la muerte.
Joaquín Martínez, who was a Spanish prisoner who was on death row in Florida and was released a few months ago.
Entregó 5,000 firmas de ciudadanos de Madrid y del resto de España a las autoridades norteamericanas.
And he was the one who handed in the 5,000 signatures that were coming from citizens all over Spain.
Pidiendo un juicio justo para Tomás Miller.
Asking for a fair trial for Thomas Miller.
It's interesting that his case is getting so much attention in Spain, Thomas Millerell on death row in Texas, and yet hardly any attention here in the United States.
Es interesante que ha recibido mucha más atención el caso de Tomás Miller, un preso norteamericano, en Europa que aquí en Estados Unidos.
Sí, Thomas Miller, de todas maneras, para para, por lo menos en España y en algún otro país de Europa donde se ha visto la película, es un preso conocido, ¿no?
Thomas Miller is a very well-known prisoner in Spain, actually, these days.
Well, we're going to go right now to an excerpt of your documentary, The Back of the World, in Spanish, La Espalda del Mundo. This is the documentary that was directed by Peruvian filmmaker Javier Corcuera. Maria Carrion also worked on it as we go to death row in Texas.
Let me say this here, all right, to give you a probably a better picture of what we're going through right now. When I first come to death row,
Thomas Mellorell,
20 people had been executed in the state of Texas. It's 180 people have been executed now. I knew at least 175 of these people as human beings, as friends.
I think in Texas, I think that it represents the large prison population, death row population. At present, we have executed 18 people this year in Texas.
Prison PR person Larry Fitzgerald.
20 inmates last year in Texas, and the year before it was 37 that we executed. I have now witnessed, I really hadn't counted on it until a couple of months ago. So I got curious. I've been asked that question so many times. This will be my 91st execution.
Once they give you an execution date and they send you a letter in the mail and they tell you that on such and such a date, you're going to be taken to the Wilds unit and hypodermic needle is going to be placed in your arm and a lethal injection is going to be pumped into your body until you're dead. Once you get that and once they give you an execution date, your mind and your thoughts can't go past that particular date. And that point, waiting, becomes a nightmare. I've had 10 execution dates. And believe me, just having one or two execution dates is enough for anybody to go through in one lifetime.
This is the actual death chamber. This is where the inmate is brought in. The inmate is surrounded by five correctional officers, members of the tie-down team. The inmate is asked to get on the table. Once he's on there, the officers will... each one have an assigned strap. They will strap the inmate down. It takes just a matter of seconds to do that. Once the inmate is down there, the IV team will come in. They'll insert IVs in the left arm and the right arm. There are five witnesses for the family who are on this side, five witnesses for the inmate's family, plus a spiritual advisor, plus five members of the media who are present for all executions. The inmate will be asked to give his final statement. That is the purpose of the microphone. The inmate's final statement, which lasts about 2 minutes, is amplified into these two rooms. Once the process starts, it takes just a matter of a couple of minutes for the chemicals to flow into the body. The first chemical is a sleep-inducing chemical. The second chemical is a muscle relaxant, which causes the diaphragm and the lungs to collapse. And the third chemical is one that actually stops the heart.
I am the chaplain for the Texas Department of Criminal Justice. This is the Texas Department of Criminal Justice Cemetery. The inmates who are buried here are inmates who died while they were in prison, including those who died of natural causes and also those who were executed. You can tell the ones that were executed by the X in front of their number. It's a very beautiful cemetery. It's used 4 or 5 times a week. It is named Captain Joe Bird Memorial Cemetery. Joe Bird was the executioner. We have men, we have women, we have all different kinds of races. They're just all mixed together. There's no segregation whatsoever out here.
There are some that affect me more than others. Obviously, the ones that I know quite well, it brings back memories of conversations we have had and some of my last recollections of that person. But it doesn't affect the way I sleep or anything like that. I never lose perspective.
Dreams. I haven't dreamed. I haven't even had it. You don't dream any of this. I have, you know. I can't recall a dream, and it's been a while since I did any dreaming. I don't even know if I can dream anymore. They got my dreams in the hand, you know?
Thomas Mellorell. in the film La Espalda del Mundo. Unfortunately, his is a true story, and he remains on death row in Texas. His execution date is February 21st. Again, his case now before the Supreme Court, and they will decide whether or not to hear the appeal that has been brought on Friday. You're listening to Democracy Now! We're joined by the filmmaker who did The Back of the World. His name is Javier Carquera, and Maria Carrion, who worked on the film and was a Democracy Now! Producer. Maria, the latest in his case, exactly what Jim Marcus is, the lawyer for Thomas Miller L., is bringing to the Supreme Court.
Well, the crux of the issue is what we just heard and saw on the video, and it's the question of jury exclusion due to race. And it's a very powerful case. I mean, Jim feels quite strongly about it. Of course, he's realistic and knows the Supreme Court is a majority conservative court. On Friday, the justices will meet. They will have a conference to decide what cases they take that are on their docket. They may not issue their decision for a few days because there's a weekend in between. So we're waiting to see what happens. If they take the case, there'll be a stay of execution. And in that case, he will not be, Thomas will not be executed on the 21st of February. But if they don't take the case will go to the Texas governor and to the Texas Board of Pardons and Paroles, and they will have a clemency petition before them. That includes the video produced by the Kunstler sisters, as well as a huge number of evidence that points to the fact that that so many of the jurors were excluded on the basis of their race.
You're going to be visiting Thomas Miller L. and interviewing him this Wednesday. You head to Houston tomorrow and then to the prison. What was it like to be on death row in Texas? You've been there several times, Maria.
Well, it's a daunting experience, obviously. And when we were there last to interview Thomas, there were five executions that had been scheduled that month, and two in a row the night we were there and the night after we were there. And actually, one of the people executed was Thomas's best friend, and that's why the interview is so incredibly compelling, because he was literally having to say goodbye to his best friend that night. They have since changed prisons. They're now in a supermax high security prison, which we've not been into. But I understand that the conditions have deteriorated, even though the old prison was terrible to begin with. But this prison, people are kept in cages, basically. They have no human contact whatsoever. There's a lot of sensory deprivation. Those are the conditions they live in.
We have Jim Marcus on the line with us right now. Jim Marcus is the attorney for Thomas Miller L. In terms of your chances on this appeal, Jim, can you explain which way you think the Supreme Court's going to rule?
Well, Amy, the Supreme Court's jurisdiction is not like a lot of other courts. It's discretionary, and they get a lot of requests to be heard every year. And they hear about 100 cases. So it's hard to even get your foot in the door. But I feel like that this is a very strong and very compelling case of racial discrimination in the selection of the jury, and that it's the sort of thing the court has intervened in the past, and so I'm hopeful that the court will step in.
How extreme was it in Thomas Miller L.'s case in terms of the peremptory challenges to African-American jurors?
Well, in Thomas's case, the prosecution used 10 to remove 10 of the 11 qualified African-American jurors. But I think what makes this case so compelling is not, I mean, obviously that's a pretty compelling number in and of itself, but also it's also the context in which all of this occurred. Dallas County has an extremely well-documented practice of racial discrimination in the selection of the jury, so much so that it's been memorialized in various manuals and internal office memorandums advising prosecutors to remove minorities. And also there's very compelling contemporaneous statistical evidence that shows that in capital cases, prosecutors were using their peremptory challenges to remove 90% of the qualified African-American jurors in this time frame. There was a study done that looked at all capital trials between 1980 through 1986, including Thomas's trial. And finally, there's evidence that the specific prosecutors in Mr. Miller L's case had also been found by courts to have engaged in this intentional racial discrimination in the selection of juries in a case tried right before and right after Thomas's case. So there's really, to my mind, no question about what happened in Thomas's case.
Will the Supreme Court hear oral arguments or just consider what you have written to them, the briefs you've presented?
What the Supreme Court will do is they will decide first this Friday whether to take the case. And if they take the case, the normal course in the United States Supreme Court is to then have a round of briefing and then hear oral argument. But again, you know, the court receives somewhere in the neighborhood of 7,000 requests to be heard every year, and they hear about 100 cases. So that's those are the numbers there.
And what difference does activism make in cases like this? We just heard about the protest of outside the U.S. Embassy in Madrid, 200 people presenting 5,000 signatures calling for the execution of Thomas Miller L to be reversed. What difference does it make in this country if people let it be known in Texas what they feel should happen?
I think it's important that everyone, including the prosecutors, the governor, the attorney general, and the courts, know that this is an issue that's important to people. And it is an issue that's important to people because right to serve on juries is like voting. It's one of the most fundamental rights of a citizen in this country. So I think that, public activism sends a strong message that this, that this is an issue of importance, and that we would like the courts to address it.
Jim Marcus, thanks for being with us, attorney for Thomas Miller L. and with the Texas Defenders Service in Houston, Texas. You are listening to Democracy Now! We'll be back with Javier Corcuera to talk about other people in the documentary, including Leila Zana, who was sentenced to 15 years for speaking in the Turkish parliament. She was a parliamentarian representing the Kurdish people for speaking in Kurdish. Stay with us. You are listening to Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. As we talk about the back of the world, the documentary film that portrays the lives of people who live in the world's shadow, a group of children who chop rocks in Peru to make a living for their families, the story of Thomas Miller L. on death row in Texas, and Leila Zana, the Kurdish political prisoner who is now in prison in Turkey. And I want to ask you about this now. Our guest is the director of that film. He's just flown in from Madrid, where he's finished another film we'd like to talk about from the Spanish Civil War. But Javier Corcuera, who is being translated by Maria Carrion, former Democracy Now! Producer, who also has just flown in from Spain. Can you give us a little background on Leila Zana?
Habla un poquitín de quién es Leila Zana.
Sí, Leila Zana es un símbolo en el Kurdistán, un símbolo de de la resistencia kurda, de la resistencia de las mujeres y del pueblo kurdo.
Leyla Zana is a symbol in the Kurdistan. She's a symbol of resistance, and particularly of the resistance of women, Kurdish women in the Kurdistan and Turkey.
Ella está cumpliendo una condena de 15 años en la cárcel por defender el derecho a la palabra del pueblo kurdo.
She is now completing a 15-year sentence in a prison in Turkey for defending the right of speech of the Kurdish people.
Y ella se encuentra muy enferma. Ella tiene bastantes problemas de salud en la cárcel.
She's very ill. She has many health problems now in prison.
Hace aproximadamente un año, el gobierno turco le ofreció una amnistía por razones humanitarias.
About a year ago, the Turkish government offered her amnesty for humanitarian reasons.
Y ella dijo que aceptaba la amnistía si era también para el resto de los prisioneros políticos kurdos y turcos.
And she said she would accept that amnesty if it was extended to all political prisoners, both Turkish and Kurdish.
El día 15 de marzo va a cumplir 8 años en la cárcel.
On March 15th, it will be 8 years since she was imprisoned.
We're going to go now to an excerpt of your documentary, The Back of the World, which shows Leyla Zana in Parliament. Can you set it up for us?
Vamos a ver un pedacito de la película que es cuando Leyla va al Parlamento a hablar. ¿Puedes explicar un poco lo que pasa en esa?
Sí, es el Leyla Zana fue elegida diputada en el Parlamento turco.
She was elected to Parliament in the Turkish Parliament.
Y el día que iba a tomar posesión de su cargo.
And the day that she was to take possession of her charge.
Después de decir las palabras que corresponden obligatorias.
After saying what she had to say, what everybody has to say when they do their swearing in.
Habló en kurdo y dijo que aceptaba el cargo por la hermandad del pueblo kurdo y el pueblo turco.
She added a few words in Kurdish saying that she accepted that office in the name of the brotherhood of Kurdish and Turkish people.
Fue un escándalo porque es un idioma prohibido y fue condenada por eso también.
It was a scandal because it's a forbidden language, Kurdish, and that's one of the reasons she was condemned. And I should add that what you'll hear, for people who are not able to see it, at the beginning, the turmoil is due also to the fact that Leyla was wearing a headband with the Kurdish colors when she went up to.
So we're going to take a look for those who are watching on public access TV stations and on Free Speech TV, channel 9415 of Dish Network, and those who are listening around the country on community radio stations. This is Leyla Zana on the floor of the Turkish Parliament. She's walking up to the front. Those colors they're yelling. She says, I swear by my honor and dignity before the great Turkish people to protect the integrity and independence of the state, the indivisible unity of people and homeland, and the unquestionable and unconditional sovereignty of the people. I swear loyalty to the Constitution. I take the path for the brotherhood between the Turkish people and the Kurdish people. Deputy, they yell, deputy. This is Parliament. This is her husband saying, what caused that commotion? A couple of words. I take this oath to the brotherhood between the Turkish people and the Kurdish people. Just a few words in Kurdish, and what a price. And then she defends herself to her accusers in court, Leyla Zana, before a military court in Turkey when she was being sentenced. We're now looking at the judge sitting down and the soldiers in the courtroom. This is Leyla Zana. This is a conspiracy. What I'm defending is perfectly clear, she says. I don't accept any of these accusations, and if they were true, I'd assume responsibility for them, even if it cost me my life. I have defended democracy, human rights, and brotherhood between peoples. And I'll keep doing so. Leyla Zana, in court, now finishing up her eighth year in prison. That from the film The Back of the World, and that was real documentary footage of Leyla Zana. How were you able to get into Turkey to do this documentary about Leyla Zana? We're talking to Javier Corcuera, the director of The Back of the World.
Fue realmente muy complicado porque nos prohibieron todos los permisos.
It was very complicated because we were denied all the permits.
Entramos clandestinamente como turistas y nos organizaron todo el rodaje y todo el sistema de seguridad, la resistencia kurda, los amigos y compañeros de Leyla Zana.
We actually entered clandestinely. We entered as tourists, and the whole filming and the security around the filming was organized by the Kurdish resistance, the friends and family of Leyla Zana.
Ellos organizaron todo, incluso sacar el material rodado del país.
They organized everything and they smuggled all of the materials, the videotapes, out of the country.
I understand there was a bus ride that we see in the film, which was her sister, I thought, going to visit Leyla Zana. How did you get on this bus?
Quiero preguntarte sobre el viaje en autobús que rodasteis con la hermana de Leyla Zana. ¿Cómo lo pudisteis hacer?
Sí, ese viaje está rodado entre 5 kilómetros, entre dos controles militares, y teníamos que viajar esos 5 kilómetros, dar la vuelta y regresar. Y teníamos dos personas del sistema de seguridad de ellos, de los kurdos, que nos avisaban cuando podíamos dar la vuelta, etcétera.
That journey was actually only 5 kilometers long. They had to keep going, turning around each time, because they were riding between two security Turkish military controls, and they had two Kurdish security people looking out, and they were the ones that would wave the bus down and tell it to turn around before it got to the next security point. So basically, they would just go around in circles.
So basically, they staged this bus ride for you.
O sea que los kurdos montaron todo esto para la película.
Sí, yo diría que ellos fueron los que hicieron la película. Nosotros les ayudamos a ellos. Fue al revés.
In reality, they're the ones who made the film. We just helped them make it. Mm-hmm.
You're listening to Democracy Now. We're talking to Javier Corcuera. He is the director of Back of the World. And it is just coming to the United States. They're actually showing it around the country because of the case of Thomas Miller L. and his imminent execution date. You're headed tonight to Boston University for a showing, to Houston tomorrow, where you'll be showing the documentary in the next few days in Dallas and Houston, and Sunday in New York City. The other part of the film, The Back of the World, is about a Peruvian boy and how he break stones. Can you tell us about him?
Habla un poquito del caso de los niños picapedreros en Perú.
Sí, cuando hicimos la película queríamos hablar de tres cosas concretamente: el derecho a ser niño, el derecho a la palabra y el derecho a la vida, ¿no?
When we made this film, we wanted to talk about three particular human rights: the right to have a childhood, the right to freedom of speech, and the right to life.
Y pensábamos que ahí estaba un poco la esencia de los derechos humanos, ¿no?
We thought maybe all of these three would contain the essence of human rights.
Pensamos que el caso de Leyla Zana, el derecho a la palabra, estaba bien contarlo en el Kurdistán, porque era el derecho a la palabra de una persona y de un pueblo.
We thought that to tell the story of Leyla Zana in the Kurdistan would be good because it would embody the right to free speech of an entire people.
El derecho a la vida, pensamos que rodarlo en Estados Unidos era importante porque es un país que se dice garante de los derechos humanos y no respeta el más elemental, ¿no?
We thought the right to life better to do it in the States because it's a country that always says that it's a beacon of human rights, and yet it violates that right every day.
Y decidimos hablar del derecho a la infancia en el Perú, porque en los últimos años en el Perú, durante los 10 años de Fujimori, el trabajo infantil y la situación de la niñez había empeorado dramáticamente.
And we decided to tell this story about childhood, or the right to childhood in Peru, because the last 10 years under Fujimori, the rights of children had eroded tremendously, and basically children were in more dire and dire situation.
Incluso se había empezado a valorar de forma positiva que los niños trabajen, los ayuntamientos contrataban niños, etcétera.
And even on an official basis, or in an official capacity, people were starting to say that it was a positive thing that children should work, and city halls around the country were even employing children.
Nosotros estudiamos todos los focos de trabajo infantil que habían y llegamos a este sitio donde trabajan los niños picando piedra y conocimos a Ginder, el niño de la película.
We did a bit of research around child laboring in Peru and narrowed it down to this one community, and then we met Ginder, who together with his friends chops rocks.
We only have 2 minutes left in the program, and before you go, I wanted to ask you about your newest film that you've just debuted in Spain in the last few days on a very different issue. If you could summarize quickly what your new film is about and who the Mackies are.
Que hagas un breve resumen.
You're
de
listening
la película
to Democracy Now.
Sí, mi próxima película, que se ha estrenado ya en España.
The film just premiered in Spain.
Habla de un grupo de gente que ha sido olvidada por la historia de España.
Talks about a group of people who've been forgotten by the history in Spain.
Les llamaban los Mackies.
They were known as the Mackies.
Y fueron las personas, los luchadores antifascistas.
And they were the anti-fascist fighters.
Que cuando se perdió la guerra civil.
Yeah, when the Civil War was lost, the Republicans lost.
Against Franco.
No aceptaron la derrota y continuaron luchando, resistiendo al fascismo desde las montañas de España, desde el año 39 hasta el año 65.
They did not accept the defeat of the Republicans and the triumph of fascism, and so they continued to fight from the mountains from 1939 till 1965.
25 years they continued fighting as guerrillas in the mountain.
Fueron olvidados, fueron silenciados por el franquismo. El franquismo decía que no existía resistencia.
They were silenced by Franco and his regime. The regime would say that there was no resistance.
Pero también fueron olvidados después de la transición democrática. No fueron reconocidos como luchadores antifranquistas.
And they were also forgotten during the transition to democracy, and afterwards they were never recognized as fighters against fascism.
Y ahora siguen figurando en los archivos de las instituciones como bandoleros. Y
and they are still known in the archives and labeled as bandits.
Well, it'll be amazing for this film to come to the United States and for an audience of Abraham Lincoln Brigade survivors who went to fight against fascism in the Spanish Civil War against Franco to watch that film. I want to thank you very much for being with us. And in this last minute, if you can tell us, Maria, where the current film, The Back of the World, about Thomas Miller L. Lezana, is now being aired in the United States and where people can get information.
Okay. First thing I'd like to give people is a website of the New Yorkers Against the Death Penalty, because they have the best website for Thomas Miller. Two clicks of the button and you can send a letter to the governor. That's www.nyadp.org. NYADP.org. The screenings are tonight in Boston at Boston University, 5:30. The building is CAS 326. On Thursday, it will be in Dallas in the evening. We don't have a time yet, but at Southern Methodist University. We can put it up on Democracy Now!'s website as soon as we have it. Friday the 15th, same day as the Supreme Court makes its decision on Thomas's case, in Houston at Rice University. That's at Duncan Hall, room 1064, and that is at 7 p.m. And Sunday the 17th in New York City at the Pioneer Theater, and that's at 6:15 p.m. on 3rd Street and Avenue A. And we will be at all of these screenings to talk to the folks there.
Javier Corcuera, Maria Carrion, thank you very much for being with us. And Maria, happy 35th birthday. Maria Carrion, former producer of Democracy Now!, it's great to have you back in the new studios at the Firehouse. Democracy Now!, produced by Chris Abrams, Miranda Kennedy, with help from Lizzie Ratner and Jeremy Scahill. You can go to our website at democracynow.org. That's democracynow.org. You can email us at mail@democracynow.org. We'll have all the schedule of The Back of the World at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Democracy Now!